Welcome into the latest edition of ESPN FC Daily. Spain and Germany played out a 1-1 draw. Feels that we went through LME, all the different results it could be. Oh, Germany are going to win, Spain are going to win. We never actually banked on these two sides drawing the second half, especially the later stages, this game really coming alive. And so much to discuss. Where do you want to start with it? Because Germany is still bottom of the group, by the way, but that point really does give them a lifeline because it means they are not out, which is what it was looking like for a second consecutive World Cup in the group stages.
The most important point right there, Kay Murray. Welcome, everybody. Hi, everybody. And yes, of course, because of that draw, they're still alive. Because of Costa Rica beating Japan, they're still alive. So German fans should be buying every single Costa Rican fan that you see around the stadium. Buy them a drink, because thanks to Costa Rica, you're still in the conversation. Listen, this was a great game. This was, to me, Kay, fast chess. Two really good managers in Luis Enrique and Hansi Flick. This was the only game in the group stages from two nations that have won the World Cup previously. And it was fantastic. Like I said, a game of chess. Spain possession-based, but also with that really good high press. Germany countering at every single opportunity. And I think it's a fair result for both. And now, as you said, the permutations for this group get even more complicated. And how could it not, Kay? I feel like every single group has its own context.
You just sent me them, right?
Yeah, I did. Okay. Read them out.
If Germany can draw here, that's this game, right? The Spain game.
Mm. Yeah. So Germany have done it. So they've drawn it. With
Germany's draw against Spain, a two-goal win against Costa Rica would be enough to qualify if Japan draw with Spain. Germany's goal difference would be up and Japan zero. So Germany's goal difference would be at a plus. Any win for Germany if Japan lose. If Japan win versus Spain, Germany could not catch Japan, so would need an 8-goal win to catch Spain. Oh my goodness.
There's
a lot to get to with this, but I just want to give props to both the goal scorers in this because there's backstories to both of these guys. We'll start with the first goal scorer then, in Alvaro Morata. We talked, LME, in our last show earlier today about how those players will run through a wall for Luis Enrique. And just today, there's a report out in Marca with Alvaro Morata talking about how important the coach's belief and faith has been in him. At his lowest points, when the whole country were against him, he didn't just have professional issues going on as a footballer. He had personal issues too. And Luis Enrique stuck up for him. He defended him against the whole country. He's continued to pick him. And he is repaying that faith in his coach. And it just adds to what we were saying earlier, in that whether you're in form or not, Luis Enrique wants you for his system. And Alvaro Morata continues to be picked by this coach and is continuing to deliver for him. It's two goals now for him in these first two games. Even when he showed his resilience in the Euros when things went against him, and that's to Unai Simon as well, who made a big mistake in the Euros and then came back from that. These players absolutely love playing for this coach.
Yeah, you described it beautifully. I think that's exactly it, to a T. Luis Enrique is a manager that doesn't just teach you the game, but he teaches you how to be a family. He helps you in every way possible. He cares about you as a human being. And Alvaro Morata, as you said, is a perfect example. And I think Alvaro Morata, for many years, has been one of the most misunderstood strikers in the game, I think. Not only is he technically so gifted, but he really contributes. And, you know, that finish was just as good as his hair, Kay Murray. He's just tremendous, tremendous goal.
Meanwhile, Niklas Füllkrug, the scorer for Germany.
What a name, by the way.
What a name. First of all, so many things about him. As you know, I cover the Bundesliga for ESPN. Yeah. Ale Moreno loves this player. He is one half of the Ugly Ducklings. Him and Marvin Ducksch call himself that, for Werder Bremen. He's done so well this year that he had to be looked at. Everybody is singing his praises, including Lothar Matthäus, who said, don't worry, Hansi Flick knows about this player. Everybody has to know about this player because he's doing so well. And really high praise for him comes from Toni Kroos, who has even mentioned the Miroslav Klose's and Mario Gomez names with this player. If you are looking for a player, a number nine style player, to come and get you those goals for Germany, this is who this man is. And he's done it today. He did it on his debut. This is a man that is in form and delivering for his country.
Yeah, what a finish. What a finish. And, you know, again, it's kind of weird because it's a mirror to what Alvaro Morata did when he came in. And it's amazing to see, just how both of these players contributed to both their national sides. And it's well deserved for Germany, to be honest. I thought they played a very good game because Spain, when they keep the ball, you might have to wait 2 years to get it back. And Germany did a really good job at, you know, trying to nullify the spaces. But equally, Spain came back with another counter. It was a great game. Love watching these two powerhouses play. Great managers, great players. Fair result for the neutrals, for sure. 1-0.
Let's get Shakir Hislop in with us to give us his thoughts on what we just seen between Spain and Germany. 1-1, that game finishing, coming alive in the second half. Hello, Shakir.
Shakir.
What we've just seen.
I thought it was an incredible game of football. As you rightly described, two of world football's powerhouses, so much at stake, particularly for the Germans. And it showed. And LME was right. When Spain are in this kind of mood, when they possess the ball, it's all about making sure you keep your discipline and don't offer them too much. And I thought Germany did a very good job of that. For all their possession, incredible save by Manuel Neuer very early on. But outside of that, not an awful lot to really worry, worry the Germans. And then the goal scored. And LME is right to point to Morata, his role in this team with Luis Enrique. Really good finish. I mean, the way he just goes past Insula, there are question marks about him defensively, but let's not harp on that. Let's look at the positives, and the positives here were Morata sitting right on Sula's shoulder, who lost sight of him for just a moment. And that's all that he needed. Perfectly timed ball in by Jordi Alba. Really good finish. And this time, Manuel Neuer could do nothing. But then sparked the Germans to life. And what you saw, I thought, was really incredible in their response. Had they lost, they're out. With a point, as you all were breaking down, they're still in. They now have to go and beat Costa Rica. Spain have to beat Japan. Both of those are very possible in a group that just threw us so many twists and turns. In just two match days, we have no idea what's going on anymore. So predict what happens after the third game at your peril. But right now, at least if you're Germany, you're still in it. You're still in the conversation.
Oh, they had to be, didn't they? It could not have ended for another group stage in this way for Germany, especially with the quality of players that they have on the pitch, LME.
Yeah, no, absolutely. We got a question here brought up to us, and, you know, I might as well just read it verbatim and then answer it as a group. But, you know, questions about Hansi Flick coming in. I've always had my hesitation about this German side. We talked about it in the preview, just because I feel that when it's your first tournament, when it's your first World Cup, in-game management and experience can be so crucial. Lionel Scaloni proved it in the first game. He learned a little better against Mexico. Hansi Flick showing it today. But I thought today Hansi Flick showed why he is the right manager for Germany, because the Spanish side, they looked like three Godzillas against Costa Rica. And there we were thinking, Costa Rica, you're awful. But they beat Japan 1-0, who coincidentally beat Germany. So to me, I thought Hansi Flick did a very good job. I don't think he's out of his depth. I think that he's a manager that's still learning. And let's remember, there are many components in this German side that are very young. I mean, my favorite player, Musiala, is 19 years old.
Everyone's favorite young German.
I mean, join the list, right? Okay, join the list, right? But, you know, I tweeted, I was like, Musiala is art. And then I got some replies saying, yeah, but he's got a few years to learn. I'm like, of course he has a few years to learn, but he's 19 and he is art. He's amazing. But my point being that this squad, this German squad, there's so much to mold yet for Hansi Flick. And I think it's going to happen. Whether it happens in this World Cup, I'm not sure. I had them getting out of this group. Obviously, as Shaka said, there are still so many things that need to happen. But Hansi Flick is the right person. Hopefully, he'll keep teaching them and the Germans will be learning. But getting this point against a very strong Spain, Shaka, is a great thing.
Just a response from Hansi Flick, just to add, after losing that first game, to make changes, to bring Goretzka in, his substitution off the bench has made the difference for him.
Yep.
I think that he's got to get some credit too, hasn't he?
Yeah, I think Hansi Flick got it right today. And let's be honest, it could have been so awfully wrong had Spain held on to that result, but they needed to get something. And for me, the most impressive thing was the response to going behind. As you mentioned, Kay, the changes made the way that this team upped their tempo and started to attack Spain a whole lot more. I thought they managed the game well. And yes, Hansi Flick deserves as much credit for that as he got criticism for their loss against Japan. But speaking about Musiala, and we had this discussion earlier today about Fernandes and Argentina, about these young players just kind of almost not recognizing the gravity of the situation and how desperately Argentina needed it in Fernandes. And I think Germany needed it in Musiala today. And the role that he played in the goal, the role that he played just kind of running and taking on the Spanish defense and giving them something different to think about was needed. Yes, you're right. Still has a lot to learn. But at some point, you just need somebody to do something different, to pose a different threat to the opposition and at least unsettle them so the more kind of organized, more strategic football can have an impact. Because otherwise, what you have is teams kind of nullifying each other and waiting for that one moment of brilliance. Musiala, like Fernandes, I thought were exactly what their teams needed, the game needed, at exactly the right point.
Yeah, incredibly, Musiala as well, one of the first names on the team sheet for Bayern Munich as well, just tells you everything at that age. The leadership even that he's got on the pitch at such a young age, he really is. Maybe it is that bravado that comes with youth. There's another question though, Luis, as to what Germany are actually lacking most in this tournament. And I know you've got some thoughts on that because we've actually spoken about this.
Yeah, a number nine, to be honest with you. You know what's really funny? I feel like in many ways...
Nicholas Füllkrug.
Exactly. Let him just come back. No, I think actually Germany are... If Harry Kane was German, Germany would be perfect. Because I think that everything that they do so well entering the final third points to a number nine that can just finish off the things that they're trying to build, you know, run off the last defender, set pieces, etc. They just need that clinical number nine. They get that and they become the, you know, what you were saying before, Kay, you know, that Germany that everybody was scared of, the closer years, etc. You know, those years were so clinical for Germany because they were the complete product. They were clinical. They knew how to pass the ball. They knew how to counter. They were physical and they had somebody who could finish it off. England wish they could build it like Germany. They are just lucky that they have a number nine. So that's why I keep thinking about somebody like Harry Kane. But if they just had a number nine in this squad, I think things would be so much easier for Hansi Flick.
Let's add James Ollie into the party, shall we? Because we've just seen a wonderful World Cup game. This is what the World Cup is all about. What did you make of it, James?
Yeah, well, what a difference a striker makes. I mean, you know, that was really the game turned on those two forwards. And, you know, Luis is right in terms of Germany. That was a huge gamble. He, you know, I think when the subs were coming up, I think people thought Havertz. And to not, if he'd not brought Havertz on and they'd lost that game, I think the knives would have been out big time for Hansi Flick there. But the fact that, you know, that striker call has paid off for him is a huge credit to him for recognising that. You're talking about Harry Kane there. You know, one of the issues with Gareth Southgate at the moment is about his in-game substitutions and whether he's being proactive enough and taking risks. Well, what Hansi Flick did there was take a huge risk with his reputation, with Germany's tournament at stake. But also, you know, you look at Spain. I mean, Alvaro Morata, I think by his own admission, he's quite a mentally fragile player. I saw him a lot when he was at Chelsea in London and, you know, the sort of weight of the world, body language he had on his shoulders a lot of the time. I think Luis Enrique has been really, really careful with him in managing him through that. And I thought that finish reminded me a little bit of Olivier Giroud, you know, the sort of the finish ahead of the near post, which is such a difficult, delicate thing to get right. And that finish was absolutely superb, very, very Giroud-esque. And, you know, I mean, look, you can criticise Spain when they score seven in their first game. But, you know, the debate about whether you can win a tournament these days, or this tournament in particular, without a number nine, without a recognised centre forward, that sort of took a bit of a blow in this game, really, because both teams were clearly better when they had a focal point and someone who could play through the middle and a finisher, effectively.
After seeing them come back then, Shaka, I mean, I'm saying come back, obviously they're just under dry in this, but mentally, Germany coming back in this game, still bottom of the group, but it is still a chance that they can qualify and get through to the knockout rounds. Given what you've seen in this game, would you bet against them progressing now?
No. I before ball was kicked, I had both these teams going through, Spain and Germany, and in that order. And right now, I'm sticking by it because, as you mentioned, and as much as this group has kind of thrown us a twist and turns, it's still highly probable that Germany beat Costa Rica, still highly probable that Spain beat Japan, which sees the Germans through. That's just going purely on form, purely on reputation, purely on squad depth. I say that recognizing that this is a tournament that's turned all three of those things on its head from time to time, more so this World Cup than any other. So it's still still a very good chance that Japan turns things on their head, that Costa Rica throw a spanner in the works. But as we sit right now, if I had to put a bet on it, I would still think I would put a bet on Spain to beat Japan, Germany to beat Costa Rica, which obviously means Spain and Germany going through.
You still going for that, Luis?
Yeah, and not much more to add. I mean, maybe Spain might rotate a little bit in that third game, but I don't know. I still see Spain and Germany going through in that order, which luckily for me, so I'm not a complete embarrassment, is what I predicted in my brackets. I think it's the only group that I got right. Everything else is an absolute.
The thing with that, LME, is Spain rotates.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
Takes that gamble.
Yeah,
and
it doesn't matter.
Japan surprises them. You know.
Yeah.
And you're, as much as we're talking about getting out of the group, there's also value to be had of topping a group. So there's a lot that Spain can't really take for granted because of how weird this group has played out. So you have to kind of almost go full strength, and if it works out that way, win it in the first 45 and then rest players if you like in the second half. But I don't think, as we said, anybody takes any result for granted.
Yeah, no.
True. Now, before we get some news from the England camp and we get our thoughts from James Ollie and what's ahead for England, we just want to mention Canada, who went out of the groups today. Well, they went out in the groups today. Obviously, it was a valiant effort from the boys. We saw that first game against Belgium when I feel as though they became everyone's darlings after just one game. Then after that game, their coach, Herdman, said, well, I'll tell you what he said, but I can't tell you it properly because this
is a family show. Oh, go on, Kate. That was what he said properly.
He said, they belong here and we are going to go and F Croatia. It's as simple as it gets. To which this obviously fired up the Croatians. We saw it in the Croatian press. They couldn't believe this was said. I mean, I thought, fair play to you, because if there's a few nations I'm not going to want to upset, Croatia is definitely one of them. And to say that as well about, a World Cup finalist, with Luka Modric in the side, two, no less.
Exactly.
I thought that is a brave move. Anyway, after the game, which Croatia won, even though they went behind first, Kramaric said, I want to thank Canada's coach for the motivation. We demonstrated who effed who.
Yeah.
Do you think it was naive from Herdman, these comments, Luis? Or do you like that he had that after that game?
Both. I love that he said that. I love the fact that John Herdman was like all about it. And yes, it was wrong because I'm just predicting. I'm imagining this sort of Rocky III situation where like Dolph Lundgren's just like getting like reffed up in his gym. And Kramaric just enters the dressing room and he presses play in front of all the Croatian. Listen, Croatian redemption is scary, man. You don't want Kramaric to be like, hey, boys, look what this Canadian coach just said to us. That's just going to rev everybody up. Oh, and by the way, they happen to have one of the best players in modern game in Luka Modric. And that's exactly what happened. Listen, like, Croatia deserved to win. Canada, like you said, has been one of the darlings of this tournament. So, and they give me a lot of similarities from my own Peru back in 2018. Played really good stuff, or at least adventurous stuff. But at the end of the day, just a little bit too naive. Also, by the way, both nations waiting 36 years for the World Cup. There was no defensive, resiliency with Canada. Every time they lost the ball, it was an absolute mess at the back. And Croatia didn't make the final of 2018 just for pure luck. They know exactly who they are. And Kramaric, I thought, was like great, but nobody was around him for like 85 minutes. What else is he going to do? He's going to put it at the back of the net. So Canada, I absolutely commend you. John Herdman, really heroic words, but yeah, nah. The Croatian revenge is here, and they took care of business for sure.
He is from my native northeast as well. Go on, Shaka.
No, let me just say, I think a lot of this is full outrage and making a story where there really isn't. And I've been on both sides of this equation, right? Immediately after a game that, you know, you make your World Cup, I nearly said debut, but it's been 40 years since Canada have appeared in a World Cup. Yeah. You battle really hard against Belgium. You know, you have a penalty saved. You play so well, and you lose narrowly by a goal to nil. And I know we were talking about Belgium earlier, but Belgium come into this tournament, I think, ranked number two in the world. And here you are, small Canada, having top CONCACAF qualifying, go toe-to-toe with them. And I understand the emotion of that situation. And he gets his team in a group, and he says, we're unlucky here, and next game, this is what we're going to do. And that's just what everybody does in that sort of circumstance. The emotions are running high. And that's what I've been there. I've heard those conversations. I've heard those things said. And to be honest, if I'm a player, that's exactly what I want to hear from my coach. That's exactly
damn
what
right.
I want to hear from each other.
Yep.
On the other side of that same coin, though, it gets reported in a way that, and now, and here's the other thing, when you're on the other side of that coin, every little thing the opponent says, you try to take and use as motivation. If the opponent dares say, well, we think we can win, we're like, well, how dare they think they're going to beat us? And you plaster the clippings.
That's a very polite way of saying what he said, Shaka.
No, all I'm saying is it doesn't matter what's said. It's going to be twisted, which is why you see managers in pre-game press conferences be as bland as they are, because they know no matter what is said, it will be twisted. But Herdman says this in an emotional time, and I stand by it. I have no problem with that.
I've got to stick up for journalism here. firstly, because I don't think a manager saying we're going to F another team needs any twisting or spin at all. It's pretty clear what he's saying. But a bit more context to that is that he said that in a flash interview, which takes place immediately after the game. And in those interviews, you know, when the blood's still pumping, the adrenaline's still there, I can see how managers can, players, whoever's doing those interviews, can get carried away. But I actually covered that game. And he came into the press conference, the written press conference, which takes place a good 30, sometimes 40 minutes after the final whistle. And he said virtually the same thing. And I think what he was trying to do, he talked a lot about the brotherhood. He used that word a lot. He's trying to get this sort of collective, cohesive, you know, team bonding. It was a siege mentality tactic, I think. And I just think it backfired on him.
Maybe
a little bit of naivety. I think he probably didn't quite understand how the Croatians were going to react to something like that. And I think if he had his time again, he probably wouldn't have used those words. So, yeah,
which is why I said, James, at the very beginning of this, I think it was great that he said it, but also really naive. I mean, ultimately, what he said was a metaphor for the match, because Canada was very eager, very willing. I'm the biggest fan of what I saw from the game against Belgium, but they were very naive in that game, specifically off the ball against the counter. And there were a few emotional choices for John Herdman in that game as well. I think a few substitutes should have come in earlier on, because off the ball, they weren't at it. And it clearly showed with a very, very good Croatia. I don't take anything away from Canada. I am so proud of what they have done. And no doubt they're going to come back and learn from this. But it's a great thing that John Herdman said that. And it's also a terrible thing, because Croatia were more than ready.
I do love it, though, because everyone's so polished these days in media interviews after games.
Exactly.
Let me just say, that's my point. To James's point, I'm not having a go at journalists here for reporting at all. All I'm saying is, from a player's perspective, if I'm Canadian, That's exactly what I want to hear from my
coach.
That's exactly what I want to hear from my coach.
Yes.
If I'm Croatian and I hear somebody say that, I know exactly how I want my coach and my press to spin that. That's how the game operates. That's how things have always been done. And for it to kind of take on a life of its own, as though this is something brand new and totally out of the box, I disagree with. This is what managers on both sides have always done in the game. They've always said things to kind of get their troops motivated. They've always heard things and spun it to get their troops motivated. This is my point only being, this is nothing new.
No, you won't hear Gareth Southgate saying that, will you?
No.
Gareth Southgate will be like, oh, well, I hope we show up.
Gareth's too nice for all that. He's far too nice for all that. But I do think part of it as well was probably trying to get his team to look forward as quickly as possible. Because I think when the dust settles on this campaign, Canada will look back at 10 minutes into the first game, Alfonso Davies has the ball on the penalty spot at 0-0. Mm. If he scores...
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
You can imagine how different that night would have been, and then the rest of the campaign potentially from there. And, you know, really, they missed their opportunity in that first game against Belgium. They were the better team by a long way. They weren't clinical enough. They didn't take the opportunities when they came. Most obviously, that penalty miss. But even they had several chances thereafter where, you know, they were lacking. Again, we're talking about a number nine. It's sort of the theme of the night, really. That was a real issue for Canada. We talk about whether they deserve more or not in that first game, definitely. But that just shows you that, you know, the vagaries of tournament football. If you miss your opportunity once, it may never come again. And for Canada, it didn't really.
Well, England definitely didn't deserve more in their last game. What's the latest from the camp, James?
Well, everybody's just about woken up now, I think, after being sent to sleep by England on Friday. it was a difficult one because I think on the one hand, the performance itself was bad. I think that's uniform and everybody can have that opinion. But the result was fine. You know, they're still on course to top the group. The control of the group is in their own hands. The players were given a bit of a time to meet their families, which they haven't been able to do since they've been here. There's usually a down day, effectively, in terms of training after the match. So I think a moment to reflect and maybe put things into a bit of context has probably been quite useful for the England players. Marcus Rashford was speaking today. And actually, I thought he was quite interesting in what he was saying, because it was this again, Shaka, this wasn't a sort of spin journalism job, but he was asked just sort of generic. I think it was the first question, actually, in his press conference, just about whether the players who haven't been playing are ready to step up. And, you know, if Gareth chooses to rotate in that third game against Wales. And he said, look, you know, the training here is really good. And it wasn't always the case that these sessions were as intense as they are. And the players, as a result, weren't always as dedicated in those sessions as they were. And that actually was quite an indictment on Roy Hodgson, who, of course, Sam Allardyce had the one game in between Roy and Gareth Southgate. But, you know, he actually didn't play in that game, Marcus Rashford. So he was talking directly about Roy Hodgson. And that, I think, inadvertently has put everything into a bit of a wider perspective. You know, the sort of reaction to the negativity around the England performance, it was sort of reframed as, well, look how far we've come in the last 6 years. You know, and the fact that we're talking about a 0-0 draw while England is still top of the group, as I say, control of the group is in their hands. Really, it's fine. You know, there isn't any major issue. I think a lot of people who paid money to come out here and wanting to be entertained, people in the bars on a Friday night, probably were thinking, you know, maybe I'll just go home and not go mad now in the club because England have depressed me too much and I don't want to go out. Or maybe they'll drink their way through it. I've no idea. But, you know, that's all is maybe. But in the bigger picture, I think what Rashford was sort of saying is, look, you know, we understand this. We can put this in the appropriate context and we're not going to panic. And the proof will be obviously in the performance against Wales and what happens after that. But I thought he inadvertently put things into a good perspective today.
What's the ceiling, Shaka, after those first two games that you've seen from the Three Lions then?
Well, it's difficult to say just because of how contrasting the two performances were, in all honesty. And to James's point, I understand. We had Nader Manua on after the US game, continually reminding everyone that this is still the best performing England team since 1966. A team that got to the World Cup semi-final 4 years ago, that got to the Euro final last year. And you have to keep that in perspective. It's important for us as analysts, and in particular for that team, to remember that. But we all know the English fans, they're expecting England to go out and win every single game by 6 and 7 nil and dominate any kind of football. And that's what England fans have come to expect. And if they don't deliver, I think, and this is where I'm going to be a little bit critical of the British media, James, I think there's never a middle ground. There's never a middle ground as to how it's reported in the press. And it's important for the team to remember that you have to be able to manage. You have to be able to manage the highs and lows from game to game and during games. And I think that's an important sign of this team's maturity in doing that.
I think
if you think there's no middle ground, Shaq, you didn't read my piece. Jane
Holly, whose pieces you should always read.
Yeah, no, but you're
all right. Yeah.
Definitely. Listen, I think that this is a good group to discuss this, right, Shaka? You obviously know what it's like as a player, and the three of us have grown up as well in that country. We know exactly the expectations. There's
I still have to say, Louise, I feel that it's reported often, Shaka, as well, to what you were saying, are the England fans a generalization all the time? They think they're going to go out and win everything.
That's where I was going.
I think it's a lot more the other way these days, where you're like, oh, gosh, how far are we going to go this time?
Except
for the last two tournaments, which we still didn't win.
there is definitely a pessimistic approach these days, and there is context to be had. To James's point, you know, it's not, you know, there is more than just the sun and the Daily Star. That there is a culture in England as well that wants to see this young team develop. My biggest issue, right, and Shaka said a very good point, right? 2018, he took England to the semi-finals. Gareth Southgate, that's the first time England has done that since Bobby Robson in 1990. The final in Euro 2020, it's a vibrant, young team, right? But that's where my criticism is, because I feel that as good as the USMNT were, because we gave him a lot of credit, it annoys me because of the talent that he has, that sometimes his in-game management is so loyalist to what he thinks overall the plan should be, that he doesn't think that sometimes maybe there should be other attempts to penetrate and try and get a goal. That's my only issue. I hope, and also it's a good point to remember that there are going to be games where you're going to struggle. Hopefully they will learn from that. And then the question is this, to me, the ceiling is this. They can reach this final. They can do it. England's biggest enemy is England itself. So as long as they can try and figure that out, hopefully that can happen. It's just that obviously, to me, my biggest problem most of the time, and I give him a lot of respect, right, as a player, former player and a manager, but sometimes my biggest criticism is Southgate's limitations into tactically what this England team can be. That's the only thing.
But to that point, Elamy, I mean, I think Gareth Southgate has been criticised for a lot of the players that he's chosen to be in this squad, a lot of the players that he's left out, and he's always remained loyal to those who've played well for him. But we criticise Gareth Southgate for doing that and then praise Luis Enrique for doing exactly the same thing. And I mean, of course, there's an argument to be had about Spain and the Euros should have beaten Italy themselves, and quite arguably could have gone on to win the whole thing, but they didn't. England were finalists, or be beaten finalists after penalties. So I just think it's how we view different managers doing exactly the same thing, and the criticisms are sometimes unfair. And I think the important aspect to that is not necessarily how we report on it, or James, or any of our other journalists, but how that's interpreted and accepted within the camp. And to have Marcus Rashford come out and speak as he did, I think speaks to a sense of maturity, a sense of we're going to do our things our way. We have to block out the noise as much as possible.
Yeah, the issue with Southgate and England to me is this. The key to Gareth Southgate's success with England is that he has, because he's steeped in the history of it, he understands the perennial tournament failings that England have had in the past, which is they don't keep the ball well enough, they make individual errors, there's sometimes a lack of discipline, and of course there's penalties. And what he's done in the last 6 years is deconstruct all of the relationships that the England national team has had with each of those issues and tackled them one by one in a cautious, intelligent, pragmatic way. The issue now is this is a young squad that isn't or shouldn't be encumbered by any of that. And he's still managing as if to avoid those pitfalls rather exactly. than taking the risk with the young group to go and say, go and win it. Go and achieve what's possible rather than think about what happens if it might go wrong and how you're going to react to it. And it's that step change that I think Gareth Southgate is struggling with. And it's often distilled into his in-game management, where at 0-0, you're thinking, okay, go on, just chuck another forward on, or let's mix it up a bit, or let's take a couple of risks, let's be braver with the ball. And I think I think that's the only element of it that he's struggling with, is he thinks this is what's got him this far. This is what's taken England to a semi-final and a final, that methodical, safety first, iron out the mistakes, you know, approach, versus this young, dynamic, exciting, exhilarating group of players who are best on the front foot. They're best, they're most exciting when they're taking risks. And that's what I think people want to see a bit more of. So the more that he doesn't play a Phil Foden in a 0-0 draw, or he talks about how good the centre-backs were in a game where England were really quite poor with the ball, the more that conversation starts to get louder and louder in the background. And that, I think, is if he can just make that shift, then England could really be a team that could potentially go all the way. I don't think they defend well enough to win it, but they need to make sure that worrying about their own limitations is not putting a ceiling on their chances.
Well, while we've got you all here, some news has come through that Inter Miami, MLS is Inter Miami, are close to signing Lionel Messi, and it would be
the England of MLS, Kmart. So that's the good segue.
Obviously, yeah, Phil Neville, David Beckham behind the scenes. But listen, bringing him to MLS, and it would be at the end of this season, not in the January transfer window. The deal would make him the highest paid player in the history of MLS. And I think you know a little more information about this, Luis, because this has not come as a surprise to you.
No, it's been a few, well, actually, really, in retrospect, you can say that it's even been a few years in the making, specifically once the Mats brothers took care of Inter Miami alongside David Beckham's ownership group, of course, and everything that's come to plan, and his partnerships with, you know, all his businesses, including Adidas as well, and Lionel Messi coming towards the end of his career, at least in Europe. So, you know, there's a few things to, first of all, know. First of all, the intention for Inter Miami to make this happen, and to your point about the offerings of what they want for Messi, is all there. They want him there. They're very confident about it. But so is PSG, because they're going to have their own offer to put in hand. And Lionel Messi, making this very clear, is not making any concrete decision until next year towards the last 6 months of his contract. He will sit down with his family, his father, of course, and his representatives to figure out what the next step will be for him. the Inter Miami move, whether it happens or not, it's important for people to remember that this is not just about him, Messi the player. It's also Messi the businessman. He already has real estate in Miami. He considers the U.S. being the next part of his Team Messi project alongside Adidas. You know, he's reportedly also hopefully bringing Sergio Busquets with him as well. I talked to Sergio Busquets in 2019. He very much told me how much he loves MLS, and the playoff scenario is very appealing to him. So there's a lot of things that are being put into place to make this happen. Whether it happens, now it seems pretty good from a MLS Inter Miami side that it can. Whether it happens or not, that's up to Messi between January and June. That's when he will make the decision, because PSG still have to put something up there. But obviously, for any MLS fan, not just Inter Miami, I mean, imagine little Phil Neville when he was a kid thinking, one day, son, you're going to manage Lionel Messi. I mean, that's pretty incredible, right?
I remember the Messis in Miami a few years ago looking at properties. And Paul, and he got mobbed. And the one thing, I lived in Miami a long time, I know enough that usually the biggest Hollywood stars can walk pretty freely in Miami in the right spots.
Yeah.
But I don't know who was looking after Lionel Messi, because he got absolutely mobbed. Or maybe it's just a difference. And maybe that really is truly how big football stars are these days, that for in some cases, they're bigger than Hollywood movie stars. But he went to this little restaurant, which was just up the road from where I live, which is a more residential area. And I don't think, because the people weren't in the know, I'm sure that the people in the restaurant must have rang all their friends, including the owners and everything, because it was swarms of people outside the restaurant, where if he'd gone to one of the ones maybe down on South Beach, he may have been more protected and allowed to go outside the back door. This was not going to happen in this restaurant, but it obviously didn't put him off. Shaka, into Miami, you see this is a good move, you know this league.
Well, first of all, quite clearly, if the Messis do move to Miami, they need to speak to Kay about all the all the good little joints that they need to visit. Because that was my takeaway, that you know all the places, Kay. Listen, players like Lionel Messi, and we've been having the same discussion about Cristiano Ronaldo recently. Players of that ilk earn the right to do whatever they decide and whatever feels right. Whatever feels right to them, and for their families. I cannot criticize that decision if that's what he decides he wants to do. I think it'll be a great boost for the league, indescribably so. It'll be a great boost for Inter Miami again, indescribably so. And for just the general sport in general, how lasting it will be. Well, only time will tell. But as from a playing perspective for Lionel Messi, he's in that right. He's in the right to play it into Miami, to retire at the end of the season, to do whatever he pleases. I just still cannot help but see Lionel Messi in a Barcelona shirt, weaving his magic as he did a few years ago, regardless of how or what clubs he's played for. And I mean that with the greatest of respect to PSG in the couple of years that he's been there, or whatever is to come next. Lionel Messi in a Barcelona shirt will always be how I picture the little magician.
Into Miami, a good or a bad move for you, James, for Lionel Messi?
I mean, I think it's a sad move in some regards, because it effectively brings an end to his career at the highest level, with the greatest respect to the LMS. He's never going to win the Ballon d'Or there. So that's, you know, that's a chapter closed. He's obviously not going to win the Champions League, these titles that he's judged by. So I think from a European point of view, it's sad. But I mean, you know, this is, time catches up with all of us eventually, doesn't it? It'll be, I think he's 36 in, is it June next year? Mm. So, you know, I don't know whether PSG could sell him another year, if there's a chance that this move could happen in 2024 rather than 2023. I think he surely would be tempted by the possibility of one last go at the Champions League, one last go at the Ballon d'Or. I don't think league titles and probably motivate him anymore, given how many he's won. Obviously, he's already won Liga. So, you know, I would just look at it, for, I guess, from a European point of view. But, you know, for the MLS, yeah, fantastic for the franchise, for the league, for the country, really, to have a player of that stature over there. And, you know, he will... he's such an enduring talent that he will be seen to tremendous effect in that league for 2, 3, 4 years, which is why if I, not that he'll listen to me, I'm sure if he watches this, you know, just take a moment, Lino, but I would, you know, give it another year if you can in Europe. I'd just love to see him.
Say it in Spanish, James. Come on.
You can translate for me, but I would love to see him have one more year.
I know all the posh places.
Those posh places will still be there in 2024, I'm sure.
I didn't say posh. I mean, it turns out they are. I just said places where it may have been a little more discreet. Mm-hmm.
We all heard you, Dickie.
Just contact me and Messi's people. I'll help you next time for a small fee. All right. Thanks so much, Shekhar and James. We'll catch up with you guys again throughout the week here on ESPN FC Daily. Looking forward to tomorrow then, Luis. A couple of standout games for us. One of them Portugal, Uruguay. The other one Brazil, Switzerland.
I know. That's an exciting little schedule there. I mean, I'm excited to see what Brazil is going to look like without Neymar Jr., who is injured for the group stage. Danilo, and by the way, Keymari reports as well from Reuters that Lucas Paquetá has been ill and hasn't been training with the Brazilian national team. So a little bit more.
It's an empty packet.
It's an empty packet. You've won Sunday with that. You've won Sunday.
The Phil Neville comment when Madison Messi wins Sunday.
And then the other game, Portugal-Uruguay. I'm expecting a lot more from Uruguay. Obviously, Ronaldo and Portugal will look to make it another victory. So, yeah, super excited. Which game are you looking forward to the most?
You know what? Portugal-Uruguay, I have to say. I think Brazil-Switzerland, obviously, it's going to definitely have some interesting parts to it, let's say. But yeah, Portugal, Uruguay, that for me is a little bit of fire and I can't wait for it. We'll be back.
Do you give me a prediction?
Do I give you a prediction?
I don't know. Do you want to?
For Portugal, Uruguay.
Yeah.
A score draw, 2-2.
Oh my God. You're giving me a draw. You're so diplomatic, Case. Too much.
I know, because it's not being... Oh, I did say a couple of draws before, though, that worked in my favour, England-USA.
Well, one of them is going to work out eventually if you keep picking draws all the time. I'm going with Uruguay winning 2-1 and bring on the Ronaldo haters.
We've already got one on here, so not to worry. All right, we'll leave it there then, shall we? He's not really. ESPN FC Daily, we'll see you tomorrow. Make sure you're with us.